Five Guys Named Mo, Louis Jordan and his Timpani Five there. One very quick final email for you this morning from Joyce Marriott, who says, I failed learning music. I took my revenge by becoming an artist. I'm 86, still doing etching in the garden shed. This is one I did in 1989. She's actually emailed it to me. It's great. On the topic of misery in music lessons, the title of the etching is We're Doing This For You, Caroline. Fantastic etching there. And thanks very much for your email, Joyce. Indeed, for all of your emails this Sunday morning. It's been great to have your company. Do join me next Sunday at 10.
Sunday Morning with Susie Klein is a perfectly normal production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Lyndon Jones.
Coming up in Afternoon on 3, a week of concerts from one of the world's finest concert halls, the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam. As well as the renowned Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra, we'll also hear from visiting orchestras and ensembles in a week that includes music from Beethoven, Elgar and Respighi, his masterpiece, The Pines of Rome. And of course, you can get the best seat in the house wherever you are. Experience the grandeur of the Concertgebouw Concert Hall, starting in tomorrow's Afternoon on 3 at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
You're indeed listening to BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 1 minute past midday. Time now for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Scott Turow is a distinguished attorney in Chicago, but he's also the author of the phenomenally successful Presumed Innocent, which dates back to the late 80s. Since then, we've had titles like Reversible Errors, Ultimate Punishment, The Burden of Proof, and his latest book is Innocent, a sequel to Presumed Innocent. The quality I get in your writing, Scott, very often, is actually a somewhat musical one. You take little themes and you move them around so that little motifs come at you in rather surprising ways. And it has the effect, I think, very often, of keeping one very hooked. You have to turn the page. Are you conscious of doing that?
I would have to claim a much more sophisticated musical education than I have to be aware of that. I am conscious of what I'm doing in terms of touching things, and I am, as a listener, aware of the same thing being done by composers, but the analogy hardly suggests itself to me while I'm writing. I'm not that adept. Actually, one of my novels, two characters have reunited after many years, and somehow they get into a discussion that I find quite fascinating, which is, why is there music? It exists in every culture. It clearly has some evolutionary function, and yet nobody really understands exactly what it is.
You have a neighbor who is an oboist.
I do, Michael Hennick, who is, I believe, his title is assistant principal oboist at the Chicago Symphony. And he's formed a little chamber group, which is immensely popular in my neighborhood. They play four concerts a year in an acoustically perfect space that was built behind a restaurant in Evanston, Illinois, where I live. And Michael and Dempster Street Pro Musica, as he calls this chamber group, perform, and it's been a delight. Nina and I really look forward to those concerts.
Now, one of the pieces you heard recently, I think, is what you're going to open with.
Right, the Brandenburg Concerto No. 5.
What must slightly appeal to a legal mind, I can't help thinking, is the way everything is so neatly tied up.
Yes, it's magnificent. The precision of it is really extraordinary and striking.
Thank you.
obviously, performance and witnessing a performance adds to any piece of music, but that one exceptionally so, particularly because of the elaborated role of the harpsichord. And to watch a harpsichordist work as hard as a harpsichordist must work in that movement is really pretty interesting. And
well, there were three extraordinary soloists there, actually, because there was Henrik Schering playing the violin, Jean-Pierre Rampal playing the flute, and George Malcolm playing the harpsichord. Mm-hmm. And he was somebody who always played as though possessed almost,
yeah,
when he played the harpsichord. You could hear it there, couldn't you?
I don't know if it's imagined or known that Bach himself played the harpsichord when this piece was played originally for the Margrave of Brandenburg. He certainly wrote himself a heck of a part.
That was part of the first movement of the Brandenburg Concerto in D, number 5, by Bach, the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, directed by Neville Mariner. Scott Durie, we're going now to turn to a subject which I imagine for a lawyer in America must have been very fascinating, because it's raised so many problems, mm-hmm, about, well, presumed guilt as well as presumed innocence.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is the subject that Gershwin tackled in Porgy and Bess.
Right, the vexed subject of race, the saying I first heard from the writer R.Z. Shepherd, I'm sure, was a borrowing from someone else, but that America was a nation conceived in original sin, and that sin was slavery.
And with this piece, it's had its problems being performed, hasn't it?
Yes, I mean, this was sort of regarded as a grand jewel of musical theater, light opera, whatever, with magnificent music. And of course, these days, it's very difficult to perform Porgy and Bess because, you know, it's regarded as offering white stereotypes of what would that at point have been called the colored community. And more's the pity as far as I'm concerned. It's quite exceptional. And this was music I heard regularly in my house as I was growing up, and was one of those things that my parents wanted me to listen to that I actually enjoyed.
Thank you.
What I've tried to do in my own work as a novelist is to borrow from the sort of high art literary tradition in which I was steeped, and at the same time to recognize the force of a popular genre like the mystery. And Gershwin obviously was engaged in that same kind of effort at fusion. And I was thinking with some despair as we were listening that that effort in American music has been probably abandoned in this generation. And we have this unfortunate cleavage between, you know, the classical and the popular without as many bridge builders anymore.
I suppose there are still some in the jazz side of things.
Yes.
You know, Marsalis and people like that.
Yes.
We'll do both. Bess, You Is My Woman Now, from Porgy and Bess, Act 2, Scene 1, by George Gershwin. That was the Glyndebourne production recording with Willard White as Porgy and Cynthia Hayman as Bess. Simon Rattle relishing the orchestration with the London Philharmonic Orchestra there. Scott, you've continued your legal activities, as I suggested earlier on. Is that partially because you like the focus of being able to have that discipline in your life as well as the writing?
I think it's because I am a really social creature. And writing, of course, whether one is writing music or one is writing a novel, is an incredibly solitary activity. And it's nice for me to get into the world to deal with people in the immediate way that a lawyer has to in trying to render direct assistance to another human being who is typically in a lot of trouble. That's why they've gone to see the lawyer in the first place. So it's the immediacy of practicing law that I really enjoy.
And it keeps you in touch with what's going on.
It does. It keeps me deeply in touch with the milieu of the law, and especially the criminal bar where I've spent my 30-plus years as a practicing lawyer.
Music, that's also a popular form next, but perhaps not so, we don't hear it so often here.
Right. Pink Martini, they refer to themselves as, quote, a small orchestra, founded in Portland by Thomas Lauderdale. And Lauderdale himself is a classically trained musician. And what interests me about Pink Martini is Nina and I have traveled the world in the last year or so. We've heard Pink Martini's music all over the world, in Greece and in Argentina, and of course now we'll hear it here in the UK. It is one of the few musical groups making a self-conscious effort to recognize that we are but one part of the world. That number, of course, is far more comic than what we're accustomed to hearing in American popular music, but it is solidly in American pop tradition. But one of the things that's interesting about Pink Martini is that they perform in a number of musical modes, and they sing in a number of different languages. They perform in Slavic languages, Italian, Portuguese, French, and it really is an effort, all of it of original composition, but an effort to create a world music.
Well, the music and the lyrics were by China Forbes, actually, the singer, Hey Eugene from Pink Martini. Now, Scott Turow, it occurs to me that you might like the way Puccini structures his music, quite apart from the melodic gift and the harmonic gift. The actual theatre is very tight in his operas.
Mm-hmm.
The acts, quite often, in some of those Bohème Tosca, they're about 30, 35 minutes, three acts, absolutely. The drama is pin tight.
Yes. The narrative force of Puccini is something that I was aware of as a child, being frequently dragged to the opera by my mother. And some of these stories, like Butterfly, were ones that I had to admit that I appreciated the story of it, even as I was learning to appreciate the music. And you're right, the narrative's quite compelling.
Thank you. and Bel di Vedremo from Madame Butterfly, Act 2, by Puccini. Renata Tebaldi sang Butterfly with the Orchestra dell'Accademia di Santa Cecilia, Roma, conducted by Tullio Serafin. Scott Turow, I gather you play an instrument yourself?
Oh, no. I had piano lessons, and my first child was actually a pretty talented pianist, and we had the same teacher, and I asked her teacher once, I said, this must threaten your belief in genetics, that she's so good after having taught me. And she, without thinking, the teacher actually agreed. But I allegedly sing, but there seems to be an agreement among the American musical press that I really don't sing.
But you get together with other writers
and
have a sort of sing-song.
I do. I play in a rock and roll band of American writers that includes Mitch Albom, Dave Barry, the wonderful humorist, Stephen King, Greg Isles, very successful suspense writer, Ridley Pearson, in exactly the same category, the novelist Amy Tan, whose work I know is well known here, and several others.
So the lyrics ought to be pretty good.
Yeah, well, they're all, we don't bother with anything original. There are a couple of original comic numbers, but Dave sings an ode to a proofreader. generally speaking, we're covering the tunes of when we grew up and doing it, as Amy says, it's all for charity, although as Amy allows, we have so much fun that we would do it to kill the whales. So,
now, I think it was doing one of these concerts that you came across our next artist.
Yes, Roger McGuinn, who is a true mythic figure in the American popular music scene, performs and just performed again with this band, the Rock Bottom Remainders, last month. For me, as somebody who was an enormous fan of Roger's, and remains such, it's been one of the most absurd delights of my literary success that I get to stand on stage and watch Roger perform and occasionally even sing with him. Although I do think the people on the soundboard turn my mic off when that happens. But Roger is a native Chicagoan and came of age performing folk music at the Old Town School of Folk Music, and that remains a great passion of his, and he's tried to use some of his lingering celebrity to reacquaint Americans with the folk music that he adored as a young person.
So is that what you've chosen?
Yes, this is a song that has all kinds of meanings to me. It's Big Rock Candy Mountain, a traditional tune with, despite its happy lyrics, actually a pretty melancholy theme. It's actually an old hobo tune expressing a lot of disappointment in the unavailability of the American dream.
On a summer's day in the month of May, a burly bum came hiking down a shady lane through the sugar cane, looking for his liking. As he roamed along, he sang a song of a land of milk and honey, where a bum can stay for many a day, and he don't need any money. Oh, the buzzing of the bees, the bubblegum trees, soda water fountain, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings on the Big Rock Candy Mountain. A lake of gin, we can both jump in, and the handouts grow on bushes. In the new mown hay, we can sleep all day. The bars all have free lunches. Where the mail train stops and there ain't no cop, the folks are tender-hearted. Where you never change your socks and you never throw rocks, and hair is never parted. Oh, the buzzing of the bees, the bubblegum trees, the soda water fountain, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings on the Big Rock Candy Mountain. Of May, a burly bum came hiking down a shady lane through the sugar cane, looking for his like it. As he roamed along, he sang a song of a land of milk and honey, where a bum can stay for many a day, and he don't need any money. Oh, the buzzing of the bees above a gum trees, the soda water fountain, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings on the big rock candy mountain. Oh, the buzzing of the bees above a gum trees, the soda water fountain, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings on the big rock candy mountain. Oh, the buzzing of the bees above the gum trees, the soda water fountain, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings on the big rock candy mountain. Oh, the buzzing of the bees above the gum trees, the soda water fountain.
Big Rock Candy Mountain, a traditional tune arranged by Roger McGuinn. Actually, it's a folk composer, I think, who wrote the music for the next piece, Pete Seeger.
Yes. Another great folk artist, a icon of my youth, although Pete Seeger was one of those musicians who was blacklisted because of his supposed communist sympathies. And so he sort of dropped out of the musical scene. And this is actually a song that I have sung on stage with Roger McGuinn, although I struggle with the harmonies.
It's a Byrds number.
It is. Roger was one of the founding members of the Byrds, the still legendary American pop group. And while we were on tour, Amy Tan brought a karaoke machine, and one of the numbers on the karaoke machine was Turn, 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 which, of course, Roger made popular, and he's probably sung 10,000 times, so he sang it on the karaoke machine, and it gave him a 94 out of 100. He was not good enough.
Season turn, 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 and then.
Well, if you thought you knew the words, they were indeed from the Book of Ecclesiastes.
Yeah, indeed.
Music by Pete Seeger, The Birds with Turn, Turn, Turn. Now, Scott Turow, you have quite a lot of expertise when it comes to the death penalty. I mean, you served on commission, you've written a book, Ultimate Punishment, about a lawyer's reflections on dealing with the death penalty. And I wonder, after all of that, where it's left you feeling about it. I mean, obviously there's the two elements, in terms of the moral question of whether you should put another human being to,
right,
to death, and the question, of course, of the fact that we have sometimes made mistakes. And I wonder where that leaves you as a lawyer.
I am against it, despite having at times in my life thought it was bearable. Certainly when I was a prosecutor, I thought I could stand up and ask for the death penalty if I had to. But my judgment on it is ultimately a lawyer's judgment, and I think where people fall down is trying to decide, you know, if there are cases that seem so horrible to them that it would justify taking another's life. And the real question, as I said, is a pragmatic one. Are we ever going to devise a legal system in the U.S. that will reach only the right cases without also sweeping in cases of innocence or cases where extraneous factors like race or gender or geography or wealth end up playing a significant role? And the answer categorically in my mind these days is no. And because you can't do it the right way, you should never do it.
Well, we're going to move on to sacrifice, but in the hands of a genius. And this piece really stood music on its head, didn't it?
Yes,
in the most
did.
Exhilarating way.
Yeah. And I listened to this piece. I've always listened to The Rite of Spring. But in particular, I started listening to it when I was a writing fellow at Stanford after finishing college, because I regarded it as a lesson in innovation. And I was just fascinated with the history of the piece and also what Stravinsky was doing in it. I recognized, even with, again, my limited musical knowledge, how amazingly innovative this piece was. Its appeal to a different tonal range than I was accustomed to.
It's a barbaric rhythm almost.
Right. Yeah. And I just kept thinking, how is it that that piece could have been scorned when originally performed and then be regarded 50 years later as a work of genius? And what was it about our ability to listen that had grown, and how plastic is our ability to understand music? I suspect it's pretty supple.
the Rite of Spring. We heard the introduction, the Augurs of Spring and Dance of the Adolescents, Igor Stravinsky's masterpiece, played by the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Claudio Abbado. Now, I think your son's got your... met the composer of our next piece.
Yes, this is my son, at one point, was hired to serve as a driver at the deservedly admired Ravinia Music Festival outside Chicago, where many of the world's greatest performers come. And although he is himself and always has been a musician, Gabe, like most teenagers, was sometimes utterly indifferent to what he was doing. And I came home and I said, well, what'd you do today? And he says, I drove a guy named Steve around and we talked about composing. I said, Steve, composing? And I went and I looked at the Ravinia schedule. I said, Gabriel, you just spent the day with Stephen Sondheim. And of course, he takes enormous pleasure now. Anytime I see anything about Sondheim, I send it to him and he's, you know, what a knucklehead I was, he's constantly saying.
He probably liked your son because he's not somebody that suffers fools gladly, I gather.
That I wouldn't know, but I'm sure Gabe told him a lot about composing. Because...
Well, Send in the Clowns from Act Two of A Little Night Music was sung by Glynis Johns in the original cast recording conducted by Harold Hastings. Stephen Sondheim's music, of course. Now, we've had Tibaldi, yeah. Scott Turow, and I guess the great debate in your mind might have been, should it be Tibaldi or should it be Callas? Well, how about both?
That's a good idea. This was, for some reason, a raging controversy in my household, Callas or Tibaldi. It was like North versus South, as if the Civil War were to be fought again. And I never have quite understood artistic competitions, especially between artists or singers. But for some reason, it was important in my house and in many others of opera lovers to decide, you know, which was the great soprano of the generation, Maria Callas or Renata Tibaldi.
One doesn't often hear Il Trittico, which is the group of three operas that Janis Gicke comes from.
Mm-hmm.
But this aria is, of course, a very famous
yes,
one.
And one that my mother played relentlessly. Do you have any thoughts, Michael, on Callas versus Tibaldi?
Well, I always thought Callas was a more dramatic diva,
yeah.
But I think they both had extraordinary musical qualities. Tibaldi was perhaps a more rounded singer in some ways, and Callas was an even greater actress. I don't know. I saw both of them in Tosca.
You know, I think listening to both of these arias this afternoon, that I think about the raw expressiveness of opera and how confusing it was to me as a child. Because, you know, the voices, the music, the lyrics are, you know, scaling the great heights of human emotion.
And, of course, it, as with your both Innocent and Presumed Innocent, so much of life is about longing and yearning.
Yes, and it's in that music. And actually, that's where I was coming from, is that, you know, I'm much more comfortable with that now.
We heard Maria Callas with the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted once again by Tullio Serafin, so perhaps he was the best person to judge, singing O Mio Babbino Caro from Puccini's Janis Gicke. Scott Turow, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Michael, for letting me do this.
Scott Turow was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week on Private Passions, there's another chance to hear Nick Clegg, leader of the Liberal Democrats and now Deputy Prime Minister, revealing his musical passions in a programme which was first broadcast in autumn 2008. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and the producer of today's edition was Chris Marshall.
Annette Crosby and David Bradley star in this week's Drama on 3.
Your depression has been very profound the last few months. We're worried that you might harm yourself again.
I won't. I haven't for years. I promise I won't.
This is just a precaution.
I don't want it.
A desperate love story.
They asked me, because I was the nearest to next of kin. I said no. You thought I signed you over to them.
Two lives entangled since childhood and their struggle to cope with the present.
You dose them up so they're like a lot of geriatrics.
Your sister is not responding to other treatment.
She's not my sister. She's not my sister.
Sarah and Ken by Rebecca Lenkovich. Tomorrow evening's Drama on 3 at 8 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
That, in fact, is this evening, I think. Did I hear the word tomorrow? I think I did. BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news from Vaughan Savage.
Two of the four Russians expelled from Moscow as part of the biggest spy swap since the Cold War are reported to be staying undercover in a British hotel. The brother of one of them, Igor Sutyagin, says he's been in touch with his family, but he hasn't been told where he is. The four were exchanged for 10 Russian agents who were deported by the United States on Friday. The British intelligence agency GCHQ says it's taking steps to improve its employment practices after a leaked report says its anti-terrorism operations were being hampered by insufficient ethnic minority staff. The Whitehall document, leaked to a Sunday newspaper, also says black and Asian intelligence officers have complained of a racist culture at the complex near Cheltenham in Gloucestershire. The Health Secretary, Andrew Lansley, is insisting that patients will benefit from a planned reorganisation of the NHS in England, which would give more decision-making powers to GPs. The proposals would mean a dramatic scaling back in the role of primary care trusts and strategic health authorities in deciding how £80 billion of NHS funding is spent. Police in Northumberland are continuing to search the area around Rothbury for other potential weapons held by the fugitive gunman, Raoul Moat. The suspected killer died after shooting himself during a standoff with armed police on Friday night. The Independent Police Complaints Commission is investigating officers' use of taser guns at the conclusion of the six-hour confrontation. The grandson of Nelson Mandela has revealed that the former South African president has come under extreme pressure from FIFA to attend tonight's World Cup final. He says Mr. Mandela, who's almost 92, hasn't yet decided whether he'll be at the Johannesburg match between the Netherlands and Spain. The weather, occasional rain or showers in Scotland, Northern Ireland and northwest England. A mainly dry day with sunny spells for the remainder of England and Wales. Temperatures will range from 17 in Perth to 25 in Norwich. The BBC News and Weather at 3:30 past one.
And now today's early music show, presented by Lucy Skeeping.
In today's early music show, a chance to hear the winning two entries from the 2010 National Centre for Early Music Young Composers Award. Now in its second year, the competition is open to composers under the age of 26 and offers them an opportunity to write a new piece, specially to be performed by one of the great vocal jewels of the early music world, the Talis Scholars. Gloria from the Missa Papai Marcelli by Palestrina, an example of the real power of polyphony. The singers there were the Tallis Scholars, recorded at Chester Cathedral as part of this year's Chester Festival. Performing music like that by Palestrina and others is exactly the sort of thing the